The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 218 for September 14th, 2009. Greetings, folks, and welcome to September. John, do you believe that this is our first show in September and we're almost halfway through it?
What are we doing here? I remember every week I do this, but I can't quite recall why I'm here. Yes, hello, everybody. Both Dave and I took a well-deserved vacation in various parts of the country, and we are back, so I am only kidding. Yes, we remember how to podcast. And boy, do we have just a boatload of things.
You know, you say about. We remember how to podcast. I'm going to explicitly go and check and make sure I'm actually recording this, which I am, which is good because we've been known to not do that from time to time.
No, that's you. I can't press the big record button.
I guess
only
that's
you
me. Can,
you have that power.
That's right. I got the power.
And maybe Pete, we should designate him a backup for that.
I guess we can.
He is the button observer.
He can take the blame. But Pete's not here tonight. Pete's off doing other things. So it is just the two of us, which is nice from time to time. Back to the old way of doing things here. And we have all kinds of stuff to go through. It's been a crazy 2 weeks, right? Snow Leopard came out, and then we did the last show, and then off we went on our various travels. And then another version of Snow Leopard came out, right? We've seen an update to Snow Leopard.
A minor update, right. Which in my case worked great. In your case, there were some issues.
All right. I guess there were. We can talk about that. iPhone 3.1 came out. New iPods came out. New iTunes came out. But let's get into the meat of what it is we do here and go through some. We've got a ton of cool stuff found in the list, John. We've got all kinds of tips that you folks found and shared with us. And then we've got some questions. So we'll do that. And then toward the end, we'll talk about the new stuff that Apple has laid upon us. And then maybe we'll talk about our travels and any cool stuff.
We'll talk
stuff
about the
there.
Travels then, because, I was just so ready to talk about some things during my travels.
Oh, we'll get to it. Yeah, let's get right into the meat of the show here.
Go.
So we talked recently, John, in Snow Leopard. There is location services or core location or some technology that allows your Mac, only using Wi-Fi, to determine its location. And we surmised that this was being done with the help of SkyhookWireless.com's Wi-Fi service. What they do is they've gone around and indexed every access point that they can drive near. And they find the MAC address of the access point. So the name can change and it doesn't matter. But as long as the MAC address is the same, they're happy. They find the MAC address and associate it to a GPS location, or use GPS to associate it to a longitude and latitude. Right.
Innocent enough on the surface that we'll get to that later. But yeah, they're collecting. Now, I don't think they're doing anything special. I think by nature, most access points, even ones where you say don't send out your name, occasionally respond to a query. And I guess this may be where, there's some ethics, but is that okay? But they're not doing anything sinister, I don't think.
Right.
So
they have
two
this,
pieces of data,
but they, I, as I mentioned on the show, I went in, I said, find my location. It said, you have to turn airport on. I turned airport on. It said, we can't figure out where you are. And so I went into SkyhookWireless.com, and we'll put a link to this because there's a place where you can submit your own access point. And so I did. I went in, and I actually have four radios here at the house, two in my Linksys router, and then I've got my Time Capsule and then the Airport Extreme. So I went to all of them. I got their MAC addresses, and I gave them, GPS coordinates that essentially let people, triangulate and send bombs to my house. Right.
So they relied on you to provide both the MAC address and what you claim is the
correct
coordinates. So
correct.
GPS coordinates, latitude. Okay.
And so I did that. And I did that on September 8th, which was last week at some point. It was Tuesday, I guess, or something. Yeah, it would have been Tuesday. And I checked today, and that was the first time I had checked. And sure enough, it worked. So, on the morning of the 8th, I went in, my machine would not find where it was. I went and entered my data into Skyhook, and sure enough, less than a week later, boom, everything is up and in the system, and it immediately found me, which tells me that that's what they're doing, and that's all that they're doing. They're not looking anywhere else, as far as I can tell. So if you want to do this, it's very simple. You just go to this website, Skyhook Wireless, and there's a place where you can submit. You put it in. They send you an email, so that they've got an email address associated with the submission. You have to go through and confirm, and then boom, you are you're good to go. And within a week, usually your access point or points will be listed.
Okay. Let me ask, do they do a CAPTCHA or something mm-hmm. to prevent automated submission? Okay.
They good. Do. They do.
You know, I'm putting on my... Mm-hmm. Used to be a security guy hat and just thinking, right. How would you screw this thing up?
Well, and then they also
bogus data.
Well, and they also make sure that that you have an email address associated with it. So presumably, yes. You know, and you have to confirm from the email that you get. So presumably, if they see a bunch of bogus data, they can, you know, track it down to an email address and say, all right, get rid of it.
Right.
But that's easy enough to fake. There's free email service.
Let me the question that came to my mind, and you may have imagined I would ask this. What if you are in that database and you do not want to be? For example, in my workplace, we have wireless access, as many enterprises do, but we do not beacon the name. It's kind of a inside.
Sure.
You got to know the name of the network to start. Then you need a corporate ID, which is unique to each user. But the thing is how some of ours, and it kind of surprised me, on one side of our building, which is closer to a public road, it shows up if I do location on my iPod Touch, which of course is only exclusively Wi-Fi.
Okay. Right. Of course.
Another part of the building where it's closer to where you cannot be driving around legally anyways, and picking up that data, it does not register. But my concern is, what if you are a, you know, no such agency or just somebody that doesn't want this data out there? As I mentioned before, it appears to be innocuous in that they're just associating two pieces of data, but what if you don't want to be in there? And I could not find a clear answer. I even went to Yahoo Answers when I asked the question, and we know that they're just a fountain of accurate.
Well, they often are pretty. I've found them actually pretty accurate. Okay.
There's a meme enough. Out there. How is Babby formed? I don't know if you've seen that on Yahoo Answers. I'll link to it. It's okay. Hilarious, but it's an example of data that is very inaccurate. But anyways, no, but it's funny. It's not. Anyways, so that's my question is how... Can you get pulled out of the database? And I still
the short answer to move things along, because we have a lot to go through. The short answer is you email them at support@skyhookwireless.com and explain what's going on. So, yeah, that's moving how you on. Get out. Yeah.
Go.
All right. Brad wrote in a very interesting thing. I'm not sure what's going on with my throat, but it sounds like I'm Peter Brady here. Brad wrote in and said, hi, guys, here's something I found useful. If you look at your system profiler under software and then extensions, you'll see what extensions are 32-bit and what extensions are 64-bit. This is helpful. If you are planning on rebooting into 64-bit mode, you'll know which extensions won't work. So, and he's right. Just like you can with applications, you can go into system preferences where you can get from your applications utilities folder, or you can go to About This Mac and go to More Info, which brings up the same app. Go down to software, twist the little triangle open if it's not already, click extensions, and you will get a column that says 64-bit Intel. And you can even sort by that column to lump all of the non-64-bit stuff, i.e. those with no in that column together. Which will be very handy, especially as we migrate further and further down the path with Snow Leopard. At some point, Apple is going to make the kernel 32-bit. Kernel 64-bit by default. And at that point, you know, you'll want to make sure you have all 64-bit extensions. Yep. Now, John, I hear you grumbling over there. There's something I'm missing.
I'm not grumbling, but I'm going to have to deliver the smackdown here.
Okay.
Because you made a claim, and I think Brad did as well, is saying that whatever you see in that system profile that's 32-bit will not work in 64-bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that was correct. It's not entirely correct. How do I know this?
Yeah.
Asks Dave.
How do you know this, John?
And you did the context switch. If you boot your machine, such as my MacBook Pro, which does have a 64-bit processor, it's a Core 2 Duo,
mm-hmm.
and you look in System Profiler under extensions, guess what? Everything appears as 64-bit Intel, yes. Now, isn't that weird? you say. And I will tell you why. Ready?
Yeah.
Not everything. So it's partially correct in that some things made it over and some things did not. So, for example, I'm going to give you a list of some of the things that I saw that did not appear as 64-bit mode and some things that did, but under a different name. So, for example, okay. I had one called Ambrosia Audio Support.
Yes.
That did not make it. But something called BSD Kernel 6.0, which appeared in the 32-bit extensions as a 32-bit, is now just called BSD Kernel, and it is now a 64-bit. So what I'm suggesting is that it is a tool to help guide you as to some things that may not make it over, but it's not a guarantee that anything listed that's 32-bit will not make it over.
I think the safe bet here is anything that's not written by Apple, and you can look to see if Apple has written it, because you're right. There. I think by definition, there have to be 32-bit only extensions that are part of the core kernel when they load. And the system, when you boot the 64-bit kernel, well, then it loads the 64-bit version of those things, which it doesn't let the 32-bit kernel see. Otherwise, you'd have a 64-bit kernel, right? I mean, there need to be core components that are kept out of this. And I'm
exactly.
Sure, right?
And I agree with you, but I did not find a way within the utility, at least this utility, to list whether it was an Apple or a non-Apple.
Oh, yeah. You can
in extensions. I didn't find a way to get that column listing. I was.
It's not a column listing, but if you look at the information for that extension, it will tell you.
All right, because I see the info window and it has, you know, version last modified, blah blah blah, and you're saying the
where I found it was the Finder's get info window.
Okay.
It definitely shows you the manufacturer there.
Yes.
So ignore the ones that are Apple, right? They will take care of themselves. Look after the ones that are third party, like the Ambrosia one. That's a perfect example. You know, if you're doing anything audio from Ambrosia, like wiretap or anything like that, we need to wait until there's a 64-bit.
Or another I found, Cisco VPN was one that just did not appear when I booted into 64-bit mode. And I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't work, which it won't.
Right.
I'm confident. So just to scratch the surface is Brad's advice is excellent. The only exception is system stuff where it's smart enough to switch it in. And unfortunately, there's no one place you can get all that data.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. Yep.
That was good.
Yep. I'm going to bounce around a little bit here. We'll come back to this iPod thing. Another thing. So we talked about this. And in the last 2 weeks, it has changed. Menu meters, which is a favorite utility of John and I, of mine and John's. God, my grammar not working. There's something wrong with my head tonight.
Your grammar good.
Yeah, thanks. It was not capable of being run on a 64-bit capable Snow Leopard machine. But that has changed. There is a new beta version out that works and seems to work just fine and runs just great. But there's also a version now of iStat Menus, which is something that does something very similar, another app that does something very similar to menu meters. And what they both do, in case you've only just started listening to this show, because we talk about these a lot, is in your menu bar, they put very handy real-time status monitors. One is for the CPU, so you can see if your CPU or CPUs, depending on how you have it set up, are being overused or if there's something going on. You can watch your network activity. You can watch your hard drive activity, and you can monitor your RAM. The iStat menu, which is the alternative to menu meters, also has a temperature monitor and a calendar thing that you can mess with, too. So I figured, you know, I'll try it. I had tried iStat menus years ago, John, and I didn't like it. At the time, menu meters would cause about a 3% CPU load on whatever Mac it was I had. And iStat menus were about, took three times that CPU space. So, you know, we were up about 10% of the CPU constantly being eaten up by iStat. And I thought, well, that's just simply too much. So, you know, back to menu meters I went. Yeah. I didn't even give it a chance. Well, now it's the same ratio is true, but we're talking about, you know, 0.5% of my CPU for menu meters and, you know, about 1.5 to 2 for iStat menus. So that's certainly well within what I would consider it doesn't matter range. And and on two of my three machines, I'm now running iStat menus. And I have to say, I actually like it. I don't like the fonts that they use to display data in the menu bar. I think they're a little bold. But the data that's displayed, especially when you click on a menu and get a drop down, one thing that's really cool is in iStat menus, when you click on the CPU usage, it shows you the top five apps in terms of what's using the CPU now. So if you see your CPU is pegged, you can just click on the menu and instantly tell, what's chewing up all my CPU. The same is true of RAM. It shows you the top five offenders when it comes to RAM. So you can look and see, oh gosh, Safari, you know, it's using 500 megs. I better quit and relaunch that. You know, that's crazy. And I have to say, although it may be feeding my OCD, or as we like to say, CDO, which is OCD in alphabetical order, like it should be, the temperature monitor may be a little too much food for that. But right now I'm still liking seeing where my CPU core temperatures are. And then, of course, you can click on the menu and see every temperature for every sensor in your computer, including, you know, hard drive sensors and GPU sensors and all that crazy stuff. So on two of the machines, I'm liking iStat menus. So we'll see if it sticks around. But for now, I like it. And it's free. So, you know, it's harmless to go and check out.
Okay, and actually, I use them, though, in the dashboard context, mm-hmm. in that they have a iStat Pro widget, which I'll look at that from time to time, but I'm still on menu meters. They had their 1.4 beta 1, I think, which as far as I can see, it's
rock solid.
I haven't seen anything break due to it in the console or any apps crashing. Right. So I'm happy. But I may look at it, just, you know.
Yeah, take a look. A couple of shows ago, at least it feels like it was a couple, it might have been the last show, we were talking about a Windows issue where a PDF was created and then sent to Windows people and it didn't work. And I believe Derek has...
Hi, Dave and John and Pete. Derek from Edinburgh here, longtime reader, first time caller. I was just calling with a point on the question in the previous podcast about the chap whose client is having trouble with jaggy text in PDF files. It may be as basic as the setting for the display with the text smoothing. You can set it for the type of monitor you're using and basically switch the smoothing off and on. We've certainly had that problem with clients of ours in the past and found that that was the thing that fixed it. Hopefully it is, and this has been of some use. Anyway, keep up the good work. Really enjoy the podcast. You may want to disconnect me now.
All right. Thanks, Derek. So that's I think that's a brilliant solution, John. Are you with me, John?
I'm with you, but I'm trying to find it. Hello?
No luck, huh? You can't find it?
No.
All right. Well,
where's it at?
that's perhaps an exercise for the listener.
Okay. Yeah, I'll find it later.
Okay, cool. Once we find it, we'll mention it in the next show. But it is there. We trust Derek that he is not intentionally leading us astray. All right, let's look at this. We'll stick in the cool stuff found category. Honor wrote in and said, I wanted to share a neat little thing that I stumbled upon. It's called Secrets. It's at secrets.blacktree.com, and it's a database of all kinds of neat secret preferences laid down in a very nice way. It's also got a pref pane that will let you see this stuff right there in system preferences. Now, John, you checked this out and you found something very cool about it and then something that was sort of disappointing, right?
Okay, back up. Sorry.
Secrets.
Oh, Secrets. So the good news, Secrets, now the cool thing, and I have it as a pref pane, Secrets looks to be a dynamically updated, I think Google actually hosts the open source project. Secrets is this huge database of all sorts of little, well, secrets in the OS itself, you know, to activate all sorts of features that you normally can't get at. I guess, you know, it's not a big disappointment, but what happens, and this is something that you may notice if you've upgraded to Snow Leopard, at least on my machine here, when I click on it, it says, to use Secrets preference pane, system preferences must quit and reopen. And if you've seen this, you may be thinking, what's up with that? And the thing is that it's realizing, because after you click and you say yes, what it's basically doing is restarting system preferences. And now, for example, I'm looking at it, Secrets in parentheses, it says 32-bit. So that is a 32-bit or whatever, some part of that pref pane is 32 bits. So that's why you have to do that reload. Because I was kind of shocked the first time I saw that. I'm like, well, what do you mean?
Yeah.
Why do you have to reload? You're there. But it makes it clear when you see the bit thing on the top of the window. But, you know, in the left column of the app, when you start it up, it shows you all secrets and then, you know, system-specific secrets for, you know, system, address book, pretty much any app that has something that's interesting to do. This has it right at your fingertips, except cool. It's 32-bit.
Got it. Okay, cool. One little tip. We got quite a few emails this week about people saying, look, ever since I upgraded to Snow Leopard, every time I launch Firefox, it launches in the background, meaning its window appears behind whatever the previously active app window was, and it's driving me crazy. Well, Michael called in with the answer.
Hey, gentlemen, this is Michael calling from Chicago. Love the show. I want to thank you for answering. I emailed in with the question of hierarchy a couple weeks ago about between Ethernet and Wi-Fi, and thanks for answering my question. Mm-hmm. And I apologize for the quote experts. You guys are experts.
Oh, you're the expert today, Michael.
I think I replied in an email to you guys. I just want to call with a quick Snow Leopard bug that I've discovered. I'm running the latest version of Firefox, and I noticed that whenever I open Firefox, it always opens up in the background, meaning that the window is not brought to the front. And I did some poking around online and had a tough time trying to word it correctly so I could find a pertinent answer. But I discovered it on a Google page, some group, that Growl is the issue. And you know, I held off from installing Growl, but I installed Adium, which is a chat program. And I think somehow Growl comes very much suggested, at least, when you install Adium. And I think it got installed through that. So I deleted that and found that that was the issue. So definitely, if you're a big Firefox user and you're having that issue where the window's not popping to the front when you open it, stay away from Growl until the next version. And I think there's some information on the Growl website about it, but I don't know specifically if they mentioned this bug, but just to wait off and hold off with Snow Leopard. So thank you, gentlemen, and look forward to hearing the show soon. Bye.
You bet. Thanks, Michael. And I confirm that it does, that is the issue. I also tried going into the Growl pref pane, John, and unchecking the Firefox and the list of applications, thinking, well, if Growl wasn't going to, you know, pay attention to Firefox, then maybe it would fix. But no, it's not.
Right.
That's not it. Yeah. So it's
a bug.
It's
now
a bug.
The earlier question, follow up, it is in the appearance system preference pane. This setting on the bottom of it, font smoothing. I was just, because I knew it was somewhere, but it's not in displays. And I think that's what was said.
Got it.
It's a logical place to put it. And I think actually on Windows machines that's sometimes where it is.
And I think that's what he was talking about, right? Was on the Windows machines, because that's where the issue was. But yeah,
I was trying to figure it to do on the Mac, and on the Mac, on the appearance system preference, font smoothing style, and you can choose from a whole bunch of things and then turn off text smoothing for font sizes, whatever, and smaller. So that would be the corresponding place.
Yeah, and you're right. Me. That is in displays, and I think advanced on Windows.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Maybe. I think so.
It's in the rightmost tab, if memory serves. So, but it might be failing me. All right.
So
our first sponsor for this show is Barebones with Yojimbo. Now, you've all heard me talk about Yojimbo before. I like talking about Yojimbo. I use Yojimbo. In fact, I'm using it right now to manage the audio and text comments for the show. Yojimbo is an organizer. It's a place to throw everything. Barebones says it's so simple, there is no learning curve. And that's true. The learning curve is understanding why you would use it. And then once you get that, then there's nothing to learn. You just use it. And so for me, I dump all kinds of data in here. I can store serial numbers in here. I can store text snippets. I can store pictures. And I can store PDFs. I can store anything. And it's all in one place. I can search throughout it. it syncs with Mobile Me, and the Mobile Me syncing actually works again with, for me, with 10.5.8 and with Snow Leopard. I had a problem. My Yojimbo store had gotten so big that that with previous versions of Leopard, it would time out. But I think I don't think it has anything to do with the versions of Leopard. I think it has to do with Apple servers, and they finally put more servers in place, and they eliminated the timeouts. But anyway, Yojimbo stores all this data. So I prepped the show down on my MacBook Pro downstairs. I throw all the PDFs in of the emails that people write in. I build the agenda, and I just drag the audio files, MP3s, AACs, AIFFs, whatever it is. I drag them right in line in the text, and I play them right there. And it just works. And I have all this data there, not just Mac Geekab stuff, but pretty much anything I'm doing. And it syncs everywhere to all three of my Macs, which is awesome. Yojimbo 2 came out, I believe, last week, certainly since the last time we did a show here. And there's a couple of things that are different. There is a new quick input panel that allows you to set flags when it comes in. You can set labels right there, and you can even type comments in. So right there in the quick input panel, as you're kind of dragging stuff in and adding things, there's new PDF workflows, meaning when you go to the print dialog and you have the PDF menu, there's better PDF workflows, because now with those, you can set the name, the tags, and label them however you'd like. Now there is in Yojimbo 2 a combined tag and label editor, which allows you to see all the tags. You can rename tags, and you can even see what tags are most related out there. So this is Yojimbo 2. Of course, there is a free trial available at barebones.com, and I believe that's 30 days long. And then once you've decided to buy, the price is $39 for an individual license. That allows you to use it on multiple computers for one person. So that's $39. If you want to do a family license, which allows up to five users on multiple computers, that's $69. And the educational individual license is $29. And I believe the upgrade, if you own a prior version of Yojimbo, if you bought it after January, essentially, if you bought it anytime in 2009, it's free. If you bought it before 2009, it's $20. So all this at barebones.com. Go ahead and check it out. I swear by it, and that's not something they pay me to say, but I would say it anyway. So thank you very much for sponsoring the show, and thanks for checking out our sponsors. Okay, let's jump back to this iPod thing, because we got a lot of feedback on this too. We talked last week, or whenever. We didn't talk last week, John. Actually,
last month.
Thank you. About some iPods, newer iPods, will not charge, or at least not happily connect, over a connector that identifies itself as being a FireWire type connector. And we got a bunch of comments about this. I'm going to share one from Mr. X here, John, that sort of explains a little bit, and then one from David that explains a great solution, the one that we were stumbling on. But David wasn't the only one. There was it would be like the Mickey Mouse Club. We'd have to run through a jillion names to thank all of you individually.
I was just there.
That's right, you were.
We'll talk about that a little later.
All right. So thank you, everyone who wrote in. But here we go with Mr. X.
Regarding the iPods and the charging connectors, well, first and second gen iPods had an actual 6-pin FireWire port on them. I didn't have either one of those. The third gen iPods also came with a FireWire charge, but they had a dock connector. And then the fourth gen iPods were the ones where they started adding USB, but they still had to charge over FireWire, and that was when you had those funky dock connectors that had both a FireWire and a USB end on them. Then starting with the fifth gen, e.g. the iPod with video, I think those ones would charge over USB, and I think at that point they dropped any connectivity over FireWire. Additionally, they've done some funky things with wanting to have Apple chips inside of certain accessories, which is presumably part of why the old camcorder AV out cable in the headphone jack doesn't work anymore. And, you know, some people have criticized Apple for not making that so that the yellow was actually video. But I actually checked the one that came with my camcorder out with a voltmeter and found out that actually that second, the first ring, which was video on it from a camcorder, would be the right audio signal from a headphone. So that's why the cables on those were a little funky if you used just your standard VCR one.
All right, so that discussion kind of moves on to into some other things, but that explains where we came with FireWire versus USB, and now the solution. If you've got a newer device trying to connect to an older charging adapter.
Hi, it's David from England here, from the I Confess I'm a Geek podcast. Just reference to your show number 216, we had a guy who had problems charging up a 3G iPhone in his Mercedes. There is indeed a gadget that you can buy. It's made by Skosh, S-C-O-S-C-H-E, and it's called the Skosh Passport. It's sold at the Apple Store online and in-store as well for $30 or £20. It solves this issue as well as issues with Audi and BMWs as well. So you can use your iPhone and it charges up while you're using it in the car. Great little gadget, bought one for myself. This is where you cut me off. Bye-bye.
Thanks, David. So that is the answer, is the Skoshi or Skoshi Passport. So definitely worth checking out. And I think you and Michael had put that a link to that device in the AAC enhanced version when he did it. So thank you, Michael and John. You put it in the show notes weeks ago, but good to mention it here in the show for everyone that that doesn't pay attention to that stuff.
I like the XPAL Power XP2. Oh no, we'll talk about that later.
Go ahead and talk about it now. It's fine.
I'm
right?
going to talk about it now because okay, so this was one accessory I brought on my trip, and I'm glad I did. XPAL Power XP2000. What is it? It's basically a portable battery.
Yeah.
The nice thing is that you can charge it off of USB, like your computer.
It's made by Energizer, right?
Yeah, Energizer is part. It's not clear to me because they call it XPAL Power, but I think Energizer is the contributor, at least, of the battery technology,
okay,
the Rabbit and all that fun stuff. So, but basically, it's a portable battery, and it holds multiple charges for multiple devices. The nice thing is that it has an adapter cable for the output that has, at least in my case, which is perfect, a mini USB connector that works on the Motorola Crazer phone, and an iPod connector that works on my iPod Touch, because I forgot to bring my cable. And if you don't have the cable, you can't charge the iPod Touch.
So an external battery with a adaptable cable that allows you to connect it to various different things that all would see that same, 5-volt
exactly,
charge from a USB port.
Exactly. And the benefit is that it itself can be charged via a USB to mini USB connector, like from your Mac. So if your Mac's plugged in, you can charge this battery, and you can even do a pass-through thing.
Got it.
So it's just a good device to have in a pinch if you don't have any cables or power sources, and you have an iPhone or a cellular phone, and they have adapters for pretty much any device. I think it depends on the kit you get. They include different ones.
Sure.
But in this case, they included the most common, which I just wish, you know, as a little tangent, every cell phone would use mini USB to charge things and not require a driver like Motorola. Though this thing gets around that, which is fortunate.
That's great. That's great. Cool.
Moving on.
Awesome. All right. We might as well just go on to David here and let her rip.
Hi, Dave and John. David from London, UK. Question regarding the malware protection in Snow Leopard. Snow Leopard's checking the downloaded files for known malware against some sort of signature that Apple have. I'm wondering if this applies to all files downloaded from all browsers. I habitually use Firefox and down them all. So the question is really, is the download checking part of Safari, or does it apply to all the browsers? Thanks very much for the podcast. Enjoy the shows.
Thanks, David. So, John, to kind of explain what he talks about here, Snow Leopard enhances the malware protection that has been available on macOS 10, I believe, since Leopard, if not Tiger. I think it was Tiger. I think it was 10.4 that started this, you know, checking stuff from the internet and alerting you to, hey, wait a minute, you know, you've downloaded this from the internet. Are you sure you want to launch it? What Snow Leopard does is it adds two things it has expanded the list of apps. So to answer David's question, yes, it's not just things from Safari anymore. It also works with Internet Explorer. Really? I'm reading. There's a great article that Dan Morin did at Macworld. We'll put a link. And it says Internet Explorer. Now, I have trouble believing that because there. I am running,
believe it or not, Dave, on my machine. You know how I am old school sometimes.
Yeah.
I have IE on my Snow Leopard machine, and it runs just fine.
All right. So Internet Explorer, Firefox, OmniWeb, Opera, Mozilla, Camino, and more. And also other email clients in addition to Mail, of course, Entourage and Thunderbird. So one thing is they expanded the apps that would be scanned, whose downloads would be scanned. The second thing that they did, John, is they added a file quarantine virus protection-ish thing. And right now, again, according to this Macworld article, which is a great, it will be, or it already is, the resource to kind of base all future work on this on. It's looking for the RS plug, Trojan horse, and the iService malware, which was embedded in that pirated version of iWork that kind of made the rounds. I guess I remember we wrote about it at TMO too. So, but there you go. So the answer, David, in short, yes, Firefox is now just as protected as Safari for what it's worth.
Okay. So this is an OS level plugin. Now it's interesting because I see this kind of related, but not as mature as the feature, which I think is Safari and Firefox. I don't know if they share the same database, but you may have seen this or not, but if you go to some sites, it'll say, warning, this site has been reported as being bad for whatever reason. I think it's a Google.
That's a Safari only thing.
That's a Safari only. Okay, but yes. But it sounds like something. I thought Google is maintaining the database.
It is. It's a Safari only thing that uses Google's database. Yeah.
Yeah. Saying, okay, this site has been reported, and you can actually get a very detailed report.
Although I think it's also built into Firefox, but it doesn't use.
Right.
It uses a Firefox way of managing that as opposed to Apple's way of managing it. But I think they're both based on the same Google database. So it six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Okay. I guess I just wanted to observe that because it sounds very cool to me that you're incorporating, or you could incorporate this sort of security, either bogus websites or malware, at a lower level than the browser itself. And it sounds like right now, at least in the browser, certain things are in the browser and they go to the same place.
Right.
But again, I think it's very cool. I mean, system-wide, you know, not application specific security and malware is something I'd like to see.
So John, I think we, based on the email and feedback that we've gotten, I think we might be single-handedly, and that's sort of a weird thing to say, we single-handedly, but we'll leave it at that. Maybe single-handedly responsible for significantly increasing the purchase of SSD drives out there. And Will writes in, all your talk of SSDs over the past couple of months on the Geek Gab has led me to my purchase of one last week. You're in good hands, Will. You're in good company, Will. We have jackets. Anyway, I wanted to know if you had any thoughts on how to go about optimizing or maintaining it on Mac OS X. There are several articles out there about optimizing for various flavors of Windows, but nothing that I can find for the Mac. After a cursory look, it seems to me that a lot of the distool programs like TechTool Pro and Drive Genius not only wouldn't help, but might even hurt depending on what you're doing. Also, I'm thinking about going back and splurging on one of the new Intel SSDs, 80 gigabytes, and then replacing my optical drive with a 2.5-inch hard drive via MCE's OptiBay harness. Any ideas on how to best allocate my data between the two to optimize performance when I need it and when I don't? And to be fair, Will followed up, and he did, in fact, go ahead and make that second purchase. So he is now a double SSD kind of guy. So
wow.
So let's answer the first question first, because that's a
first
nice
question.
Quarter.
Dave, do you have the tune queued up?
No, you don't. I don't. That would have been a good one, though.
Oh, man.
Go ahead. Sing it for us, John.
Well, basically, the tune is do-do-do-do. Don't touch this. SSD drives, here's my quick opinion. SSD drives operate in a fundamentally different fashion as far as what a sector means versus where it is physically on the device. Because in this case, you're not talking a circular platter. You're talking a memory chip, basically. So all the things that are taken into account when you're trying to lay out data on a hard drive to make it more efficient just doesn't apply to a solid state drive because it's not physical. It's electronic. It's It's kind of virtual. So if, and I would agree, if you're going to do something that assumes, oh, well, now first I would assume that some of the utilities would be smart enough if they go to the device and say, okay, how many cylinders and heads do you have? It would say, you know, I don't know. They would say, you know, I'm not quite sure what device I'm talking to. You're not a hard drive. I'm really not going to mess with you. So that would be one thing, is kind of thinking like a developer, I would just check for. Or say, are you an SSD?
I'm going to try that with, I have not tried it with Drive Genius's optimized tool, but I am going to try it. I'm not going to let it run the optimization because, as you just said, John, that is the worst. If you want to pick the worst thing that you can do to an SSD, that's it. And the reason is...
Maybe not worst, but it's a bad use of your time and the device's time. Because
you have limited write cycles, right?
Yes, I agree with you there. It's so burn...
You have a finite amount of write cycles before the device starts to stop accepting writes. It reads are fine pretty much forever, but we'll stipulate that, right? But but writes are limited. Now, you're not going to run into it, you know, after a week.
They're like hundreds of thousands, but still, over the lifetime of the device, you don't want to.
And a defrag is just constantly reading and writing little bits of data all over creation. It's to me, it's the absolute worst thing you could do. But you know, John, as far as maintenance goes, I would not do an optimization. I'm also a little worried about Apple's hot files management, right? I mean, it's only moving small files around, but still.
I'm going to think, because it's somewhat sensitive to... I thought it was sensitive to the part of the drive it put things on. So again, I'm going to assume an intelligence saying, you know, this isn't a hard drive, or at least the hard drive that I'm used to talking to. So I'm just not going to try it. And my assumption may be wrong here.
Yeah.
I'll
say this and then I'll let you go. What I would say is doing directory maintenance, i.e. doing a verify disk in Disk Utility or repair disk in Disk Utility. That doesn't fix the disk. It fixes the directory or the table of contents of the disk, right? We've talked about this before. What happens is you have the list of all the files and folders that are out there on the drive. And as you remove things and add things, that list becomes, it starts out kind of like a tree, and it starts out very orderly. As you start pulling things on and off the drive, the branches wind up getting intertwined. It becomes like a crazy little bush, and sometimes things don't point where they're supposed to. They get messed up. And so fixing that stuff, that has nothing to do, in my opinion, with what kind of media you're on. That needs to be maintained. So, doing disk warrior or Drive Genius repair directory, that to me is still something you want to do, once every couple of months. So, but go ahead, John. Yeah.
Where was I going? SSDs. Let's see. I'm sorry. Okay. The one point is that on some drives, like the Intel drives I read up on, there is one thing you can do, at least at this point, they're working on this, where I think you can do a full secure total delete of the drive to bring it back to a totally virgin state. Now, we talked about this before. In general, SSDs, once you've gotten through an entire write cycle where every cell in the memory of the drive has been hit, eventually you're going to suffer a small degradation. And they really try, and that's why I think we're talking about not trying to do optimization. The drive already has something called write leveling and some other algorithms that really try to spread the data out and the read and write cycles in a fashion where there's not a spike at any point on any cell, because as you pointed out, we both pointed out, Dave, the cell's not so much reading, but writing. You can only write a certain amount of time. So it's already taken care of. The drive knows what to do. So my advice is, unless you really want to reset to day one and squeak out a couple of percent, which to me, I don't think it's worth it.
Yeah.
Let the drive do its thing. Do not run optimization. Hopefully they will be smart enough eventually to say, I'm on an SSD. Either they come up with a brilliant new algorithm, because there is talk of selective erases. As we've talked before, there's a disparity between the read and the write size, and normal optimization doesn't work now. But there is talk of giving greater control over what you can read and write, the granularity of that. So there may be optimizations down the road that traditional utilities take care of. But at this point, as we said, don't touch this. Just let the drive do its thing.
All right. So Will followed up and asked, how should I allocate my data? And he sent another email through, which I didn't prep in our, it's not sitting in Yojimbo. But he asked essentially, you know, should I put my user folder on the spindle hard drive or on the SSD drive? What about like the library folder where caches are stored and all that? What about my iTunes library? What about my iPhoto library? And to me, I've had great luck and the best speed by keeping all of those cache files and everything on the SSD. Now, it does incur more writes. So, you know, maybe I'm impacting the device unnecessarily or perhaps necessarily to eke out some more performance. But I would say for your iTunes library, definitely get it off the SSD. You don't need to take up that space with files that you're just going to read, you know, sequentially and play it. You know, those don't need to be read very quickly. You know, you're playing a file that requires 128 or maybe 256K worth of bandwidth. You know, you're not going to see any speed improvement there. So do that. And I would say the same with your iPhoto library. That's going to grow very large very quickly. So go ahead and put that on the drive. You probably would see a speed improvement if you had that on the SSD. But if you don't have the space for it, then go ahead and get it off. You know, pick the stuff that you're using all the time where there's lots of reading and writing. And to me, that's the best thing for the SSD, at least the SSDs that we've been talking about, the higher speed ones. Yeah.
Okay, not really having used them all that much. I'm going to give a totally uninformed viewpoint here, which I'm sure will be welcome.
Yeah, yeah, go ahead, John. We love that. Do you want me to hit pause now? Or no, just kidding.
You did start recording.
Right? I did start recording, yeah.
Great. So what I would say is without question, the thing that these drives do better than anything else is reading. Read speed is phenomenal. So for things that you pretty much read all the time, like apps, right, or utilities or certain folders, where for the most part you're just loading a program or something, to me there's no question that goes on the SSD. Now, I'll toss it around with you a bit, Dave. I think it deserves some experimentation. If you have folders that are being often read from and written to, I try it on both. I mean, I would sense in a lot of places. Now, you got to balance this, as you said. iPhoto, I think I'm with that because the pictures tend to get very large, at least, you know, like, for example, my pictures are 9 megapixel photos. So, you know, I got like gigs and gigs. So I would agree with you where the amount of data being read versus the amount of data being occasionally written, where there's enough of a delta there. So I would say iTunes and iPhoto and things like that, plus things that you just want to maintain
right
for a while. I'm trying to think of situations where you want to leave it on a hard drive if you do have a physical hard drive.
Yeah, I don't know that there is any one thing that you would say, oh, definitely don't put that on an SSD. For me, it's more about, you know, let's face it, dollars per megabyte SSD is ridiculously expensive, right? So anything that you're going to just store and archive and not access a lot, get it the heck off of your SSD. You know, leave your SSD for the stuff that you're using every day, because that's where you're going to see the speed benefit.
Okay. Now, so an archive, physical, yeah. You would say that archiving or a backup would be a role for the physical drive.
Absolutely. Okay. Unless
I'm with you on that.
Unless you needed the speed, because you know, I'm going to disagree with your suggestion that perhaps anything that you're writing regularly you don't want to store on the SSD for speed purposes. Now, the SSD drives that you and I have, John, are at least three times, maybe even four times faster at writing.
I'm going to modify my statement. Okay, can I do that?
Yeah, of course you can.
Even
sure.
If you say I can't, I will. When you're writing large data files, movies, I would say that for writing, because the one downside we saw in the SSDs is writing of many teeny weeny files, performance is lacking at this point. So I'd say if you're writing big old files like movies and music and like, you're doing like we're doing here, a big whopping audio file. In that case, I would say the SSD is clear. If you're writing a lot of little files, the SSD may be on the same level as a mechanical hard drive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You're not going to see a whole lot of speed improvement, except that when you write or read to or from a mechanical drive, And I don't want to beat this horse too much further.
Beat it, brother.
But when you're accessing a mechanical drive before the reading or writing can start, the drive needs to move its heads to the next place where that data can be. Now, it's either overwriting data or it's, you know, finding a new spot. That then the data starts being written, right? On the SSD drive, that first step essentially doesn't happen. The data can just start being written immediately. And that is huge. So, you know, I think there is still a speed benefit when writing small files to an SSD drive, because you're not waiting for the writing to begin. I'll agree with you, John. Once the writing begins, the speed's about the same for, you know, small little files, you know, 50K or less or whatever it is. But, you know, it does make a difference. In fact, to me, the biggest difference you get from SSD drives is that, you know, essentially no seek time, where you're not waiting for the heads to move.
Right. So, and latency and stuff like that. Yeah. Actually, I'm going to finger wag you, but I've been finger wag for this too.
Yeah.
SSD drive is like saying VIN number.
I know.
That's all I'll say.
Yes,
I'm sorry. I've heard it. I say it. Yeah. I don't mean to corrupt the English language.
Yeah, that's
but,
true.
Sometimes it just happens. So
yes. But if I said SS drive, it would, you know, somebody would think I had some, you know, 50-year-old German things laying around. So I have to say SSD, right?
I don't think so.
I think they would. I think they would.
Move right along.
Okay. See, it's the same sort of thing, right? Apple came out with a bunch of new stuff, and I think it's time to jump to that that thing. You talked about the thing from your vacation, right? There was nothing else to nothing to see here, nothing else to mention.
Very quickly.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Here we go. So I stayed at the Omni. Very nice. Champions Gate. It's in the Orlando area.
Okay.
Or the Reedy Creek, Improvement District.
Improvement District. That's right. Yep.
Yes. Anyways. But anyways, so here's the creepy thing that happened. So I went to the Omni. It's a national chain. It's a very nice hotel.
Yeah.
And the friends I was traveling with had friends there. So we got like friends and family rater. You know, we did good. It was more affordable than the Disney properties, which can get pricey, but they're fun too. We stayed in Animal Kingdom. So anyways, get in the hotel, try to hook up to the wireless. It's just not working, even though there's supposedly free wireless on our floor. As part of the bonus package.
Sure.
So anyways, so I look in the desk and there's a 100 base T connector. I'm like, wouldn't this be sweet if this worked? And I brought my Airport Express.
Naturally.
And there we go. So I set it up, turned on security, WPA2. Now, the funny thing was I plugged directly briefly into the 100 base T connection. Dude, there were a lot of people there with Macs because they were just sharing like there was no tomorrow. I looked in my network shared and I'm like, who are all these people? And I clicked on a few and their public folder was open and there were all sorts of movies and pictures. Then I stopped, you know, my conscience kicked in saying, this just ain't right. But their machines were open. So, of course, putting the Airport Express, I had a little, at least a rudimentary firewall built in. So I didn't see any of these other people or because it's
sure.
It didn't hop over the connection. So anyways, I set that up and then I griped online on Twitter and I said, yeah, I'm at the Omni and the Wi-Fi is not working. Within minutes, I got a tweet back from Omni Hotels saying, oh, if you have a problem, we can help, you know, we can send someone to your room to fix it.
Whoa.
Oh my gosh. And then, so that was just the general Omni Hotels, and I'll link to their account, of course, account. Then I got later on a tweet from a person that actually worked in that specific hotel. So the other was a generalized thing.
Sure.
Probably just getting me a call center. This was someone that worked at the place.
Dude.
And at one point, I mean, we missed each other, but, you know, at one point I'm like, well, we're going out to the pool. She's like, yeah, well, you know, maybe I'll come out there and, you know, meet with you guys. And I had her name and I tried to meet her at the front desk. She was on, you know, we just didn't meet face to face, but it was an individual that actually contacted me. So this hotel chain gets it. Okay.
That's huge.
It is huge because it's almost like some of these others, Comcast Cares and a few others, but just whoever this is, and I'm going to link to them, but Omni Hotels, they're a great chain, you know, they're throughout the country and in Orlando. And we just, but just the responsiveness of these people that they almost got to the level of address, and they did, addressing me personally to solve a problem.
Yeah,
it
that's
was awesome.
Huge. That's awesome. All right, so we're talking about Twitter. We might as well talk about our contact information, and we'll turn it around. We'll start at the top with our Twitter contacts, and then we'll talk about other ways to chime in here at the Geek Gab, and then we'll talk about the new stuff from Apple, time permitting.
How can you reach us, Dave?
Twitter. So it's twitter.com/John F. Braun for that guy over there. Dave Hamilton for this guy over here. Pilot Pete for the guy who's not here. Mac Geek Gab for our show wide Twitter account. And then also Mac Observer for the site wide Twitter account. And basically all you're going to get at Mac Observer is the headlines, the stories, and some people like that. If you follow Mac Observer Live, that's only used when we do live coverage of Apple and other events, which like we did last Wednesday during the what turned out to be a Steve Jobs speech. And so you can follow that there on Twitter or visit us at live.macobserver.com when those events happen. So that's Twitter. Mm-hmm. Now you can call us, and John, you have the number, don't you?
I found it written
etched on a wall somewhere.
I've had it written on a wall in a room somewhere, but it's 206-666 for a good time or a good podcast. Call 206-666-GEEK, which is
4-3-3-5. That's great. Okay. So you can email us to feedback@macgeekgab.com. You can visit the show notes at macgeekgab.com, and you can Skype us to, yes, you guessed it, macgeekgab. So that's
Dave, I want to make sure you said feedback@macgeekgab.com.
I said feedback@macgeekgab.
Thank you.
I said it and I meant it. Yeah. All right. So there was this Apple event, and there were a couple of things announced. Now, there's one thing I want to talk about with iPhone OS 3.1, which is in some ways a maintenance release and in other ways makes some cool features available. But one thing is very important to us, and that is, I believe, once and for all, perhaps, the iPhone bug where if you download an AAC version of our podcast, either download into the iPod portion or stream it directly in iTunes, both of them now are fixed. So that this issue is no longer, you can play it like an audio file that it is. You're not stuck dealing with it as though it were a movie. Whatever funky stuff Apple was doing that was getting it wrong, they fixed it. They were actually very, very helpful and worked with us on this, but it took a little time, obviously, for them to, or for the powers that be there to decide, yep, time to roll out at 3.1. So we're there. Everything's good on that. I've tested it. You folks have tested it. We've heard reports. So the world is at peace again now, at least in terms of that. So it's, you know, a small step. Anything else with iPhone OS 3.1, or should we just dive right into Snow Leopard 10.6.1?
3.1, did they introduce, it sticks out to me, a remote passcode lock. Little modification.
Okay. Is that new? I thought that was in 3.0, but it might have been. Yeah.
I think it was a 3.1. Okay. They actually listed the slide. They listed.
Yeah.
The other thing I noticed, iPod or iPhone 3.1, I think this was in iPhone 3.1, was fine-tuning of the information that you sync back and forth. I think it's partly the OS and partly iTunes.
Okay.
But I noticed that you could, you know, sync more specific data by, you know, certain subcategories than you did before.
Got it. And while we're at it, and this dovetails into iTunes 9, which I'm sure we'll talk about at least a little bit, I do like the ability to manage the way your apps on your iPhone or iPod Touch are laid out on your Mac, because you can grab multiple items. I don't know if you folks noticed that, but you can hold down the shift key and select multiple items when you've got your iPod or iPhone plugged in, select multiple items and move them around from screen to screen and lay things out there. And then it just syncs back to your iPhone. So you're not stuck doing it in the, nervous app, wiggling phase there. So
right.
Much, much, much better. But let's talk about Snow Leopard, since we are, you know, Mac guys and a Mac podcast. 10.6.1 came out. Now, you said I had a problem with it, and I believe you, but I don't remember what my problem was. So,
well,
would
I think
you had
some mail. I do believe you said some mail plugins were not functioning quite as you expected. After, and I'm like, Because I had no problems. I'll bring up the page here in a moment.
Sure. But no, you're right.
That's what you mentioned, right. And I think there were fixes. But actually, I'd like to know how that worked out.
Okay. So, yeah, this was interesting. And I wound up talking to Scott Morrison at InDev, who makes mail Acton and mail tags. And then also to, and I can't think of his name. It begins with a K at, it was Glenn Aspislaw at Ecamm Networks, who... They both confirm this because Ecamm makes DocStar, which is another mail plugin that I use. And what happened is Apple with Snow Leopard decided, we've had issues where we've done point releases of the OS and minor issues have cropped up with mail plugins. So what we're doing now is if we push a new version of mail, you have to push a new version of your plugin that adheres to what, that has been tested with and explicitly in its code states, I will work with this new version of mail. Now, for a lot of plugins, it's not going to require any code changes. It's just, you got to go in and say, here's the ID of that version of mail. Yes, I've tested it. It works with it. So go ahead and take it. And all in all, it's a good thing, right? Because it ensures that mail plugin developers are staying up to date with this stuff. And so that's a good thing. So, but it was somewhat disconcerting to, finally have gotten all my mail plugins set up right in 10.6. I mean, it only been 2 weeks since this thing was out, and then suddenly this new version and it breaks them all. It's like, oh no, but the fixes came within hours. So,
dude, you should just follow my example and use Eudora and Spam Sieve.
They're
actually running better under 10.6, I think I told you, than 10.5.
Spam Sieve wouldn't have worked either. Oh, it would have worked in Eudora, but not in Mail, because it's a plugin that needed to be updated.
Right. I'm telling you, you got to,
I'm not going to run Eudora.
Sometimes works. No.
I use IMAP, and Eudora's IMAP functionality is flawed at best.
Well, actually, I still do, the old thing.
I know.
So anyways, there was, what did I see here? I think they addressed one thing in 10.6.1, which was a little flash security oopsie.
Yes, that's
right.
That
we talked about earlier, but I guess they fixed that. And just minor stuff here. I'm looking, Macworld has a thing from Ted that talks about some of the little tweaks here and there. But it broke a few things for you. It didn't break anything for me. I didn't notice any big improvements. So.
No, it sort of worked. So iTunes 9... The home sharing is an interesting thing. We can now copy files back and forth in iTunes as long as both accounts are authenticated to the same iTunes store account. Now, it's important to note home sharing authentication is separate from your iTunes store authentication. So, for example, my wife and I can have different iTunes store accounts on our computers that we use, but home sharing is all linked to one account so that we can move stuff back and forth. Now, you can also set it to automatically move any purchased content back and forth. But it is sort of confusing that you're not changing your iTunes store account. You're just changing what account is being used for the home sharing. And I think that's more a nod to the record labels saying, we're going to let our users do whatever they're going to do with the data because they're doing it anyway. So we're just going to make it easier because that's what we do. But, they still have to use their password. So if you're comfortable giving someone your iTunes store password, you're probably comfortable sharing your music with them anyway. So I think that's the mentality there. But you do not have to have that in sync with the password you're actually using in the store. And that's an important thing for everyone out there to note. Anything else? Before we kick in the band and I get to go watch the Patriots.
No, there was the Nano, kind of unexpected.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was really expecting, as maybe you were, if anything got a camera, it would be the Touch. But I don't know if there were logistics problems or, as they said, the Touch is a perfect little game machine. And we're pretty happy where it's at. I personally think, and I hope I don't get, the Apple cops don't come. But I just think they something slipped and they wanted to introduce it on both, but they couldn't. That's just my wild speculation. I don't know.
It would have had to have slipped a while ago, right? Because the Touch, You know, they revamped the guts of it, right? You know, it's got a faster processor. It's got, I believe it's got more RAM, right? They doubled up the RAM on it, right?
Yeah, yeah, so they're improving it.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's like, well, if you're going to do that, you know, you're going to redesign it. You're going to know that the camera's coming, and obviously they can fit it in because it's already fit into the, oh, well, maybe they can't fit it in because the touch is a lot thinner.
Well, there's this spot in the touch that looks like a camera or some of its working should go there, or something should go there.
Right.
I'm still not quite sure what.
I don't know. You know, the thing is though, I don't think Apple initially realized how big of an impact games were going to make on the touch or the iPhone, you know, on the iPhone OS platform, because it's huge, you know, and some people say, well, you know, the tablet is going to cannibalize the touch if Apple ever comes out with a tablet. And I say, no, you know, these are people that haven't seen a 7-year-old boy who wants to hold something very small in his hands. It's either, you know, and I'm talking about my son here, but my son is a classic example. And he's, you know, in this respect, certainly not unique. You know, he's got his Game Boy or he's got his iPhone, and he's, you know, he has our old iPhone, so it has no service on it. So he essentially has an iPod Touch, right? And what he does is he wants to have something that he can stick in his pocket and play little games on. And the cool thing about the iPhone is, you know, on the Game Boy, if he wants to buy a new game, that's, you know, at least a month's worth of allowance, if not two. On the iPhone, if he wants to buy a game, it's, you know, less than a week's allowance. He just, go ahead, Mom. Right. Sure. $2. Yeah. No problem.
And they pointed that out. You saw the presentation.
Yeah.
They pointed out where games available for, you know, Sony and Nintendo and iPod, and then I'm looking at the numbers here. I just happen to have them handy. From what they said, 30 million iPhones have been sold to date, but 20 million iPod Touches have been sold to date.
Right.
And I'm convinced most people, like me, don't, at this point in my ownership of, you know, that type of device, I don't care about the phone yet, but I want all the other cool stuff it does. And, you know, so it doesn't have GPS, it doesn't have a camera, and it doesn't have phone. And that's pretty much the only difference between that and the touch. So.
Right. Right.
And it works great for me. I love it as a portable terminal. The Exchange thing, I've raved about that before. The Wi-Fi, it has Cisco VPN that works, unlike Snow Leopard, which is broken there. Still.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm working with the people at work. So, and the band.
The band's here.
It's nice weather to be out.
It is. I love this season. Yeah.
It's
my favorite. All right, so
we did the info thing, so we don't.
The one thing that I hate doing during the fall, and I try my darndest not to travel during September or October. However, in October I have a couple of trips, unfortunately, but one of them is out to Vegas, which I'm actually looking forward to. The timing is, for me, like I said, I'm not, you know, I don't like to travel then, but I'm actually excited to head back out to Vegas this time for Blog World Expo, John. We're going to be there October 15th through 17th, and I believe today is the last day that your 20% off Observer VIP coupon will work, but try it, and we'll see the show. I think there's several hours left in today, and we're going to get this MP3 out now, so if you hear this, Observer VIP, and John and I will be there.
I don't think I used the code, though.
You didn't need to, John. It's okay. We get our own passes. It's kind of part of the deal. It's okay. It's part of the quid pro quo, if you will.
They know who we are.
Well, yeah, and we know who they are. So there you go. And we know where they live. That's what it really comes down to, isn't it? Right. iPhoneAlley.com is a virtual location you can visit, and you don't have to leave your home. And that's where Michael Johnston spends all of his time when he's not converting this show into AAC for you and for us. Cashfly Hosting provides all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. The podcast marketplace includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Yo Jimbo from Barebone Software, PDF Pen from Smile on My Mac, and Text Expander Touch from Smile on My Mac. Notebook from Circus Ponies and Pathfinder 5 from Coco Tech, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network, and we certainly appreciate their sponsorship. And we appreciate your patronage of them and of us and of everything. It's all good. There's a lot of appreciation to go around, John. And I appreciate that we've got another show and we're pretty much done, and that's a good thing.
Yes, we're back.
We're back. That's right. And as John said before, for a good time, call 206-666-GEEK.
Which could be 4-3-3-5.
So remember to have fun, take care of your shoes, but don't get caught.
Made up.